is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Mark Pizing, author of N4 Down. This is the story of the early part of the 20th century and the search for achievement, adventure, and conquest of the North Pole. The subtitle, The Hunt for the Arctic Airship Italia. Mark, congratulations and good evening. We go immediately to an exciting scene in your book. July 25th, 1925. We're in Norway at a house, an alpine-like house in a part of Norway that is on the Bunes Fjord that leads into the Oslo Fjord. And the name of the alpine house is Uraniborg. Who is present at the meeting, and why is this important for Arctic exploration? Good evening, Mark.
Good evening, John, and thank you very much for having me on your show. Present at the meeting, you've got some of the main characters of the story. You've got Roald Amundsen, who is obviously the famous Arctic explorer, first man to the South Pole, led the first expedition through the Northwest Passage. You had Umberto Nobili, who's probably less well-known, who was a kind of a genius Italian airship designer, pilot, and had aspirations, I guess you could say, to be a polar explorer. And you had Lincoln Ellsworth, who some of the audience I know kind of, heir to the Ellsworth fortunes. He worshipped people like Wyatt Earp. Later on in his life, he wore apparently Wyatt Earp's wedding ring for luck. He explored the Antarctic later on, and the Antarctic transpolar flight in the early 1930s is one of the great triumphs of exploration down there. And then Risa Larsson, who most people won't have heard of, but he was Amundsen's right-hand man. He was a very skilled pilot. He has some knowledge about how to fly airships as well.
They're meeting to plan an expedition that is proposed of an airship, not only to the North Pole, but an airship for the first time to fly over the North Pole. So why is Amundsen here? His success was at the South Pole going overland. Why does he want to fly to the North Pole? What does that mean to him, Mark?
Well, I guess you could say it's unfinished. There's two things. It's unfinished business. He wanted to go to the North Pole back in kind of 1908 and 1909. Two explorers called Cook and Perry claimed to have got there, so he kind of had to kind of divert his interest towards the South Pole, so he never quite achieved that goal. He became fascinated by aviation, so he could see the potential for aviation as a kind of way of kind of covering the distances so much more quickly and more easily than slogging it out on foot. And this is towards the end of his career as well. I mean, I characterize it in the book as one last big paycheck. He was kind of constantly broke, constantly bankrupt, and I think he was reckoning that this flight, along with all the kind of lectures afterwards, the best-selling book, would be his kind of ticket into retirement.
In other words, this is a world-famous hero out of funds. Hence, Lincoln Ellsworth is present because he's financed. Now, the Risa Larsson is Amundsen's best friend. These are Norwegians. Yeah. They're very, very famous worldwide, but they're worshipped in Norway. Umberto Nobile, airship designer, airship director during the war, the Great War. What do we need to know about Umberto Nobile? Why does he want to go to the North Pole?
Well, okay. I personally, in my reading of him, his family, he's a kind of descendant of aristocrats who've lost their status and lost their land, in the reunification of Italy. So there's a sense of, I think, of trying to recapture some of that glory. Other people will probably disagree with me. He was an incredibly talented young man. He studied in kind of engineering in a lot of detail. He got taken up by Arturo Crocco, who's a kind of another genius Italian kind of engineer who especially in the West, I don't think we've heard much of. And he kind of got into airship building in the First World War. And I guess like lots of engineers who I met writing some of my articles I've written for the BBC and other publications, airships seem to seduce engineers and become obsessed with them. So he started to build airships with Proco during the First World War, became director of the kind of the factory the Italians had to manufacture these airships at quite a young age. After the war, they carried on. He was one of the designers of the Roma, which obviously crashed. The Americans bought off the Italians. And he was under a lot of pressure as well. I mean, he was known not to be, he refused to sell his factory to kind of, various kind of, I suppose, speculators after the First World War. These speculators, I guess you could say, morphed into the fascists in Italy. So he was seen as being not one of us. He was seen as perhaps as being sympathetic to socialism and communism. So he was also under pressure in the kind of Mussolini's Italy. Because, I mean, Mussolini gained power in 22-23, and in the March from Rome. And so they were now in power, and he was seen as being, is he really one of us? Does he support us? Lots of people were quite jealous of him as well. So I think he was also looking for something that's going to protect him as well.
So at this meeting, which is secret because they don't want attention, and at this meeting in which they will soon sign a contract for the purchase of N1, that's the name of the Italian-built airship that will become the Norgay, a Norwegian. They're keeping the secret, but each man at the table has a motive that isn't entirely about exploring. It's about either vindication or triumph or cash. And with Nobile, because he lives a very long time, it's every possible motive. The Mussolini connection is especially rich. What does Mussolini make of Nobile at this moment, 1925?
Well, in 1925, Mussolini seems to be on very good terms with Nobile. Like the fascist movement, all the fascists in Italy, they kind of worship aviators. The aeronauts were the kind of almost like the personification of fascist ideology. So he is seen, along with a number of other kind of pilots, as being kind of the future of Italy. Nobody could have put one-to-one meetings with Mussolini, like he did with the Pope and the King. So he was very well thought of, other than in terms of, whose side is he really on?
So this is putting together, I'm translating into the 21st century, this is putting together SpaceX, commercial space, go to Mars and the moon without the state and being worshipped for it. Putting it together with political ambitions globally, global political ambitions, and a contest between Norway and Italy. Did I read that correctly, Mark?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There was a kind of a power struggle, I suppose this expedition, Amundsen's ambitions, brought these two very different kind of cultures, very different different, I suppose, systems together, and almost created this clash.
Yes, we're in the midst of a drama here that's about to take flight. I'm speaking to Mark Pising. Remember, this is about a tragedy that reveals the contest, the nationalism contest of the early 20th century that will turn into the catastrophe that we remember as the Second War. N4 Down is the title, The Hunt for the Arctic Airship Italia. We're going to lift off next for the Arctic. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Mark Pising, the author of the new book, N4 Down, The Hunt for the Arctic Airship Italia. But not yet. All great failures expeditions have predicates that set up the failure. And this is a success, sort of. It is 1926. And in a place called Kings Bay, they've constructed a hangar by hand, and it's weathered the winter. And in March of 1926, approaching the northern tip of Norway for the launch to the North Pole, is N1, which has been specially rebuilt from a luxury craft for cruising the Mediterranean, a lighter-than-air craft, to an Arctic explorer. And Nobile's done it. Mark, what do we know about Nobile's change of N1 into the Norgay? What's he done to it?
Well, one of the key things is, basically, the key thing is make it lighter so you can carry more fuel. So that means getting rid of the gondola as it was. As you said, it was this kind of luxury thing for the king and his entourage to kind of fly around the Italian Mediterranean processions. So that was stripped out, made a lot lighter. I mean, although the phone was kept, perhaps I imagine nobody has an idea of coming back to Italy and the king riding in his airship again. And it was things like the valve inlets to the envelope, trying to protect things from the ice, you know, because, you know, everyone warned him that if you're going to take an airship up into the North Pole, one of the biggest dangers is ice forming on top of the great envelope, because this airship was about the size of a A380. You know, so it's a huge craft, and all that could be covered in ice. So it's, you know, how do we protect that from ice? I mean, it's that kind of thing. Basically, making it lighter, so you can carry more fuel, go further, and can protect against the ice.
Let's take them off, because there are a lot of details here, and there's lots of tension between the Norwegians and the Italians, between Nobile and Amundsen. On board is Nobile as the captain, Amundsen as the great explorer. The pilot advisor is Reiser Larsen, Amundsen's lieutenant. There's also a scientist on board, Holmgren. They lift off and they fly direct to the North Pole and circle it and drop a flag at from 600 feet. It's a success.
And, fantastic.
And yet the success has contradictions, because Amundsen – it finds himself a passenger. Did I read that correctly, Mark? He resents the fact that he's not commanded this expedition.
Well, I think he's normally in command, and the big thing is he sits down in this chair, in the captain's chair, and from nobody's perspective, he doesn't really move, doesn't really do anything, and leaves the piloting to other people. So it's a question of, I guess you could say, he's the figurehead, and Nobile is doing the kind of hard work along with a few other people, and perhaps Reiser Larsen as his kind of co-pilot, maybe.
They fly over the North Pole, they fly onto Alaska, and now they've been running into constantly bad weather. Holmgren is the meteorologist, always giving them positive forecasts that don't work out. They're flying blind. Is that it, Mark? They're in a fog.
Yes, right. At times, blinded through mountains, which is always fun.
They have a radio on board. Are they in contact with anyone as they cross over into Alaska?
They are to a point, and then you have this period of kind of radio silence, where they kind of fall between different radio stations, a range of different radio stations. Or if you're cynical, kind of, I once Googled, for a talk I did last week at the Explorers Club in New York, I Googled, Amundsen missing in the New York Times archive, and there's over 100 entries. So if you were cynical, Amundsen going missing is a kind of a trick you'd regularly play in his expeditions, because you obviously, you boost up the ratings, you boost up the demand, what the hell, you know, you get the headlines. So there's some cynicism about the kind of the airship's kind of radio silence.
Radio silence, but they do reach Alaska. They see an Inuit village. They decide not to land. They're on for Nome. And at this point, because I knew they were going to live, I thought, well, how do you get out of this one? Nobile makes the decision to land without a village, without a pole.
Yeah.
And he manages that in crosswinds. No, does he land in nowhere, or is there a village where they land?
He lands in a place called Teller, which is just short of Nome.
I see. And he then has to destroy the airship because they can't anchor it. So he's destroyed N1, but they leave Alaska for Seattle on June 27th, and he's feted all the way across America. Is that correct?
Yeah,
he's in the newspapers from Seattle to Washington.
He is, yeah.
And does Amundsen get the attention in the same journey?
I think Amundsen does get some attention, but he and this is a bit of a generalization, basically kind of slinks off, kind of sulks off, if, if, in a way, because he obviously expected to be the hero, and suddenly it's nobody's the hero, and I think he finds it quite difficult to deal with. So he basically kind of heads home. I mean, clearly he does get some attention. We don't want to simplify this too much, but it's nobody is the hero. Nobody is called the new Columbus. Nobody meets the president. Nobody is greeted at, New York City town, City Hall, things like that. No, all the crowds are Italians. I mean, you've got to remember, this is almost like a battle for diasporas. I get two diasporas, the Norwegian diaspora, and the Italian diaspora. And the Italian diaspora is huge. And they've also been organized. Again, the story, one of the dark undertones is the Fascist League, the American Fascist League, which is kind of organized the Italians. Armistead was up against a lot, really, in terms of getting the column inches.
The success here is in headlines. And yes. A subplot of your book, Mark, is that Nobile is aware you need to take along journalists. Amundsen's aware that journalists can be your best friend. Mussolini's aware. For heaven's sakes, everybody seems to be aware that journalism transports a crazy idea into legend. At the time, your reading of the newspaper sources, and you're a journalist, were the newspapers going along with this? Did they understand that they were being played?
Well, I suspect rather like some, recent political events in both our countries, the newspapers, wanting sales. And these characters, and to some extent, the battle between them generated sales. I mean, it was big news. And the New York Times, when the Norge reached the North Pole, they devoted three whole pages of the newspaper to it. I mean, this is big. This is kind of big money, I guess.
Despite the fact that the Norge was in the possession of Benito Mussolini. Who was no friend?
He'd sold it to the Norwegians at that point.
I understand, but that's a fig leaf because they dropped an Italian flag over the North Pole. Is my memory. Yeah. So if you want,
and it's the biggest of the two, yeah.
Right? If you wanted to find something edgy here, it would be the fact that Mussolini is boasting of the success of his fascist state. But yeah, I'm laying on 21st century politics.
He clearly was. I mean, clearly this was a general. He took a personal interest in this fight. He was very keen to boost the support of his regime in the diasporas in North America, Australia, and South America. And that was clearly one of the agendas. He wanted to portray Italian fascism as modernizing the country, modernizing the aviation industry. I don't think that's reading into it. I think that was very clearly, and that's part of what the stakes were for Nobile as well. He wasn't just trying to achieve his own goals. He had all this other stuff behind him. And I don't think Armistead ever really appreciated the stakes on the Italian side so much.
In this instance, and we'll turn now to the big expedition in 28. In this instance, it reminds me of how the Soviet Union used Sputnik and then the Gagarin flight.
Yes, absolutely.
To vindicate their brutality by saying we're progressive.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly the same playbook.
We're going to the North Pole, and this time we're not going to make it successfully. N4 Down is the book, The Hunt for the Arctic Airship, Italia. Mark Peising is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Mark Peising. His new book is N4 Down, The Hunt for the Arctic Airship Italia. It is now 1928. Our hero, our protagonist from Italy, Umberto Nobile, has put together another expedition to the North Pole, this one to top everything, to land at the North Pole, perhaps to circumnavigate the Arctic. He's got a new airship this time, which he's dubbed the Italia. It's no longer sharing with Norway. Mark, what is important about the design of the Italia for the Arctic?
Well, I suppose it's almost exactly the same as the N1, I guess. And I suppose the N1 is a proven design. And the N4 is almost exactly the same. I suppose it's a bit more designed for the Arctic. outright. So it's a game, the emphasis is on lightweight, making sure everything's still protected, trying to learn the lessons from the earlier flight. So it's a very similar aircraft. And that's part of the problem because, when nobody decided to go, he wanted to go to the North Pole, which is almost that moment when he landed in Alaska, he decided to go back, which is not surprising in a way because the North Pole exerts this amazing effect on people. I mean, I went up to Svalbard to research my book and I just want to go back. I mean, it burrows into your soul in some strange way. So he had this obsession, but his idea was to go back in a much bigger airship, much more like the ones that his rival, Hugo Eckner was building.
The Zeppelin airships of Germany. Eckner had inherited Zeppelin's fleet. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So he wanted to have a much bigger airship, so it'd be more stable. You'd be able to carry out more scientific research. And these things always have science as a kind of fig leaf or the disc. And you could argue how valuable any of the science was. But he made, and the airship was going to originally fly from Rome to, Buenos Aires or Rio, to kind of do a similar trip just to build up Italian propaganda for Mussolini. Then he was going to repurpose it for this kind of Arctic flight. But he made one fatal mistake. He went to Japan immediately afterwards because the Japanese had built one of his airships, bought one of his airships. So he went there to train their crew, I guess to get worshipped, to gain, all the adulation of the crowds in Japan. He was seen as a hero. He was on the cover of textbooks and things like this. But when he was there, Italo Balbo, who we mentioned briefly, had become the kind of the head of the Air Force, and he didn't like airships. He saw they were the past, and he didn't like Nobly. So he used Nobly's absence to destroy this large Zeppelin-like airship, totally destroyed, melted it down. And so there's no way that when nobody got back, he could kind of resume this project. So he had to go in back to the Arctic in this smaller airship, although it's still the size of the A380, but relatively small.
So the airship that Noble was building was not available to him. He had to go back to the original design. So N1 and N4 are the same airships. Is that correct?
Very similar.
He makes a dash to Berlin in March of 1928 to meet Rudolf Semyonovich. Who is that?
Well, he was the head of, he was one of the most veteran Soviet explorers, I suppose, going back into Tsarist days, Tsarist explorers. He's the head of an institute in St. Petersburg, in Leningrad, I think it was called by then, into kind of polar research. So he had access to all the research the Russians or Soviets had done, which obviously hadn't been translated into German, Italian, or English. And he's an expert on those areas.
So let me set this up now. Our hero, our protagonist, Nobile, has enemies in Italy. One of them is head of the Italian Air Force, Italo Balbo. He has rivals everywhere. However, at the same time, he's admired by the Soviet Union. Yeah. He's worshipped by Italy. And he's suspect to Norway and to the north where he's headed because he has to launch from the northernmost port in Norway. Amundsen is not invited. What is Amundsen's opinion of Nobile now in the spring of 28?
Well, he writes this book called My Life as an Explorer, which is the kind of book that he shouldn't have been allowed to publish. Someone, his publicist should have said no, in which he I suppose that he's this kind of, you have to think that he's out in this kind of villa, his house, on this fjord. He's withdrawn into himself. I think increasingly, I suppose we'd say he would have mental health issues. He's probably very depressed. You know, his big triumph has been taken over by a young upstart Italian. So he writes this book, not just about the flight of the Norge, but about all his expeditions. And he attacks everyone. He attacks so many people, but especially Nobly. I mean, he really goes for him. So Amundsen detests Nobly, sees him as the enemy. So they're really falling out with each other.
The preparation for this expedition includes an Italian rescue ship commanded by a man named Captain Romagna, CITE, we'll call it, the CITE of Milan, the city of Milan.
Yeah.
What do we need to know about Romagna? He's a suspicious character, but who's he working for?
Well, this is a good question. You know, I think I started off when I was writing this book really seeing him through nobody's eyes as this kind of stooge for the fascists. And that basically his job was to sabotage his expedition because Balbo famously said to Mussolini, let nobody go back to the Arctic because he can't possibly come back to bother us. So there's a sense of, yeah, let him go and he'll die a martyr and we've got rid of him. So nobody certainly saw Romagna and some of nobody's friends and fans saw him in that this way. But there's also another story. I mean, he's a Navy officer. He wants a career. He's working in the Navy and like nobly, you know, it's a difficult time, isn't it? You know, Balbo, Mussolini are in charge. You know, he has a life. You know, he has to make choices. He's probably also quite a conservative character. And he was right about some of the warnings about the limitations of the Italians operating in these conditions because his ship isn't particularly designed for the Arctic. Some of the men aren't. Some of the soldiers they had, special forces, were trained for the mountains, but not necessarily the Arctic. So I think you can see him in many different ways, but it's fair to say that history hasn't necessarily been kind to him.
Yes, when you press into this story you've written, Mark, there are huge questions that haven't been answered in all these 90 years, and we're still searching for motivation. All right, one more ship coming to the attention of this expedition, the Krasin of the Soviets. What is that?
Well, this is a huge, powerful pre-First World War icebreaker, which I think was built in Britain. It's a very powerful ship. It'd been laid up in Leningrad for, I can't remember now, I think it's about maybe a year. The crew had all been broken up, kind of moved away. And what they were realizing was that there's a big divide when they're trying to work out how to rescue these guys. One is by aviation, by planes. One is by airships. But there weren't any really around at that stage. I mean, the Graf Zeppelin was a possibility, but Hugo Egner, had offered it, but it wasn't quite ready. And perhaps you could argue the British could have offered some airships, but the British refused to be involved in any of these activities. Like Brexit, you know, as a British person, you can't help see some of these things in that event. The British refused to be involved. And so one of the main other options is to get there by ship. Now, no ship as big as the Krasin had ever broken that far through the sea ice. So it was a risk. But the Soviets, a bit like Mussolini, Stalin's, agenda was the same. You know, it was propaganda. You know, right. what better outcome would be if a Soviet icebreaker rescued the fascists?
Now, remember, all of this is anticipation of a disaster. Nothing's happened yet, but we're going to crash the ship very quickly. It's the middle of May. They take off and they reach the North Pole. My time says at 2:20 a.m., at 12:24 a.m., May 24th, they fly over the North Pole. And I like this detail, Mark. They have a gramophone on board, for heaven's sakes. And while they circle the North Pole, they play a fascist hymn, and I guess they all sing. It's a strange detail. However, they've now circled the North Pole, and they're heading back. Suddenly, loud cracks start sounding. And they are now struggling with a fog bank. What's happening to the ship? What are the cracks?
Well, the cracks are ice smashing into the gondola. It's the sound of the kind of structure. These are really powerful winds they're encountering, kind of twisting, you know, being subjected to forces that perhaps they didn't quite understand. So the whole ship is really struggling in this kind of fierce fog, wind, terrible wind.
There are 16 men on board. Yeah. Some of them are asleep in the balloon itself. Some of them are on duty and sleepless in the gondola where Nobile is. At around 10:20 a.m. on the 24th, we have Mark quoting one of the survivors, "We are heavy. The control cabin and the rear engine, they're sinking, sinking, sinking. Yeah. Smash into the ice." What happens to the ship, Mark, once they smash?
Well, this is horrific, because the airship doesn't really crash. What happens is it smashes into the ice tail first. The gondola gets crushed and stays on the ice. Two of the engines get knocked off, and then the rest of the airship actually floats away, this time under no kind of control. Amundsen, sorry, nobody kind of recovers consciousness from the crash, opens his eyes and sees the big Italia on the side floating away into distance. And in the hole, there were the six men who are still in the envelope looking down on the people on the ice. It must have been utterly horrific. And the survivors describe seeing their faces change as they realize their fate, the fate that awaits them.
Right. They were never seen again. One of them, though, Ettore Arduino, yes. An engineer, does a very brave thing. He throws over fuel, food, a tent, pistol, and a portable radio to the men on the ice. That saves their lives.
Absolutely. Otherwise, they would have died from exposure very quickly.
All right. Of the 16 Amazing. Men on board, six are now gone and never seen again.
Yeah.
10 are on the ice in various damage. And when we come back, the rescue effort that was anticipated is now underway. Mark Pising is the author. N4 Down is the book. The Hunt for the Arctic Airship Italia. We're about to join the whole world in the hunt. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Mark Pising's new book is N4 Down, The Hunt for the Arctic Airship Italia. All the geopolitical forces have come to bear on rescuing Nobile, this global hero who is a pioneer of the progressive thinking of the 20th century, led by the fascist regime in Italy, celebrated by the communist regime in the Soviet Union, admired by the democracies, the capitalist states of Calvin Coolidge in the United States. However, you've got to find them. The Crescent sets sail. The city of Milano, captained by Captain Romagna, doesn't set sail. Pauses, wants to know, at checking with Rome. However, the one we want to concentrate on is Amundsen. We have to finish this subplot. Yeah. Amundsen hears of the crash. Reeser Larsen, his right-hand man, hears of the crash. What do they think? What do they do, Mark?
Well, the official narrative, I guess, is that they're having dinner in Oslo with a whole bunch of other explorers to celebrate Hubert Wilkins' achievement of flying from Alaska to Svalbard, almost the wrong way from where everyone else is trying to fly, in April. And they're having a dinner to celebrate this amazing achievement. And the kind of, it's like a Hollywood movie. The messenger arrives, the door swings open, and the news is that Italia has disappeared. No one's heard from her. And when they realize there's a crisis, Amundsen, the whole room apparently turned to Amundsen to see what he would do, because they knew that of his animosity to Nobile. And Amundsen stood up and went, "I will go." So you have this great moment of the explorer's code, isn't he? You know, even though he hates this guy, he's going to go and he's going to rescue him. But things turn out to be slightly more complicated than that. Reese Larson, has his own agenda, I suspect. I mean, he is very much the de facto kind of lead of the expedition. He's organizing some of the first aircraft to go up to the Arctic. Norway has to, the Norwegian government conveniently, because I don't think they particularly want to deal with Amundsen anymore because of this book. My life as an explorer, he's burned lots of bridges. He's seen as being someone you don't really want to deal with because he's going to attack you, publicly. So they have to ask Mussolini for and suggested that Amundsen should lead the expedition. Mussolini says no. So he has which is quite a nice little subplot. Reese Larsen is then in effect the kind of the de facto person in charge of it. Anyone's in charge of it. I mean, it's fairly chaotic. And Amundsen now thinks Reese Larsen has betrayed him. So he only hears that he hasn't become, he's not in charge of it after Reese Larsen heads off himself, to the Arctic. And Amundsen has to hear it secondhand. So he adds on Reese Larsen onto his list of people who betrayed him.
However, by the middle of June, Amundsen has made his way to Tromsø, the northernmost city of Norway. He's found passage on a Latham 47, a flying boat. And they take off on the afternoon of the 17th, is my note here, at 4 p.m. And they're seen to be flying heavy, but they do get off. You get a message at 6 p.m. They're flying towards the north. Nothing to report. They haven't reached Kings Bay yet. They're flying to Kings Bay, which is the launch point. And at 7 p.m., they get the message, do not stop listening, message to follow. What happens? What do we think happened, Mark?
Well, the last people who saw them were some fishermen, and they saw the plane fly directly into this huge kind of, you know, huge kind of cloud, I suppose, kind of sea to, you know, thousands of feet high clouds, and the plane disappeared into that, and that was the last time anyone saw it. We know cloud is very disorientating, especially if for these early aviators. So easy to lose your sense of, are you upside down? Are you the right way up? What direction are you going? We know the plane was underpowered, or the pilots thought it was underpowered. It's probably overloaded as well. So I think there's lots of speculation about what happened to it. I mean, most assumptions are that it's crashed. Certainly a float was found later from the plane that had some, that seemed to indicate some damage of it that must have hit the water at a height.
And is it fair to say, Mark, we're still looking for Amundsen?
Absolutely.
Okay, back to Nobile. The whole crew will survive except for Holmgren. However, what's important here for Nobile's reputation is that when a rescue plane does find them, they've painted their tent red so that he finds them eventually, lands on the ice, and he only has room for one passenger. And he takes Nobile off and leaves everyone else. What does Nobile say about that decision, Mark?
Well, his justification was that he needed to come off the ice in order to, because he was the best person to organize the rescue operation, search and rescue operation, for not just the men with him, but also the men who disappeared as well. And he was the best person, you know, to do that. It's probably, it's a catastrophic decision on his part, and the story is probably the rest of his life. So.
Right. It's, 90 years later, we're still talking about that decision to leave his crew behind. Now, they are rescued, except for Holmgren. They are all found not by the city of Milano. No, by that Soviet icebreaker. Krasin finds all of them and takes them back. But there's a coda, an coda, and a coda. Nobile arrives back in Rome in July, and he has an audience with Mussolini. What happens, Mark?
Well, Nobile has a face-to-face row with him. It all starts off very well, and then I think Nobile and Mussolini is very polite, very nice, and Nobile just explodes because he's seen the propaganda the kind of fascists put out about his decision to leave the ICE. He's seen how they've encouraged other newspapers around the world to challenge that decision, to subject it to scrutiny. And he's seen the lies about some of his injuries. For example, there's a story that he, when he was rescued, he was fit enough to run up the steps to the city of the Milano ship. But actually, there's a picture we use in my talk at the Explorers Club, which shows him, he has been lifted up. Now, he's no way, he wasn't in that situation. He wasn't like that. But the fascists had, and his enemies had used this as an opportunity to totally destroy his reputation. And he didn't know any of this until he got to the ship, when he was placed under house arrest. And then when he got onto the train, so hire a special compartment, a bit like Lenin, to take them from Norway all the way through Europe. And then he's given all the newspapers that he hadn't read. And then he realizes, it explains a lot of people's reactions to him. And he's just so angry. He loses it with Mussolini.
We're talking about a man, Umberto Nobile, who will live another 50 years. Of thinking about the decisions he made in N4 Down, The Hunt for the Arctic Airship Italia. Mark Pising is the author. What follows that meeting with Nobile is the tragedy of the 20th century. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.